The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 286.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Welcome to this evening's live stream. It is great to be here. I was in Orlando, Florida this weekend speaking at my good buddy Jason Hartman's conference on real estate investing and macro and freedom and liberty and all that good stuff. Before we get into it, I want to encourage everyone to check out rebelcapitalistlive.com. If you haven't heard, we got Ron Paul, G. Edward Griffin, Lynn Alden, Chris Cole, a lot of other of my good buddies like Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang. Oh boy, we got the uneducated economist who is very educated. And just last week, my good buddy Robert Kiyosaki said that he's going to be there speaking as well. So check that out at rebelcapitalistlive.com. There's nothing better than to see people face to face. I think that's where we really build community. And we really learn how to build wealth and thrive in a world of out of control central banks and big governments. I don't know if I told you guys, but I've rented a couple actual offices, and we're going to be setting up a real studio next week. So we're going to be taking it to the next level for the interviews and the Rebel Capitalist channel. And actually rented some space from my good buddy, Robert and Kim Kiyosaki. All right, let's see what we got here. Do you think a centrally planned economy? We're going to start off with this question, huh? All righty then. Do you think a centrally planned economy assisted by AI could reasonably set prices, ultimately leading to modern, authoritarian, centrally planned society that won't fail like USSR? Well, Mr. Surf or Mrs. Surf, I'm not sure if you've watched my whiteboard videos on this, but this is the direction I think that the global elite at the World Economic Forum and the IMF want to take it, because they're all Marxists. You know, whenever you have someone come out like Klaus or Benioff, who is just a Klaus mini-me, and Benioff is the CEO of Salesforce. But regardless, any of the Davos types that come out and talk about neoliberalism and how we've got to get away from neoliberalism. Ooh, sounds scary, doesn't it? Whenever you hear someone talk about how bad neoliberalism is, first and foremost, what you need to do is realize that person is 99% most likely a socialist and or Marxist. That's just their buzzword. That's what all of them do to try to throw free market capitalism and Milton Friedman under the bus. That's just kind of, they think they're being very clever by calling it neoliberalism because it sounds so scary, like it's the boogeyman hiding under your bed. Or like it's something contrived from a Mussolini or a Hitler or Stalin or some sort of dictator like that. When really, if you just look up what neoliberalism means, I guarantee if you do that, you're going to be like, wow, that sounds pretty good. I like that. Because it's just free market capitalism. The laissez-faire government, small government. It's very consistent with Austrian economics. And Hayek and Hazlitt and Friedman and Mises and Rothbard and all those dudes that were pretty darn smart. I'd throw Thomas Sowell in there as well. So bottom line, though, is they realize that one of the massive failures with the centrally planned economy in communist Russia is they didn't have any price signals. There was no price discovery. Now, sure, they had prices, but all those prices were set by the government. They weren't set by supply and demand or anything that would tell you or the resource producer how to allocate those scarce resources that have alternative uses. So as an example, in a free market system, and I know it's a stretch to call the United States a free market system, but in a system like the United States, if we see lumber prices going up significantly, then we know we need to produce more lumber. And we need to produce, we need to cut down some more trees or do whatever they do to produce lumber. And if we see a regional discrepancy, maybe for concrete or whatever the resource may be, then that supplier knows that they need to send more of that supply to the area where prices are going up, because that tells them that the demand is outstripping supply. But how do you do that? So the bottom line is the resource is going to where it will be utilized the best. And it's you know, Schiff always uses the example of why they don't put use gold for you know, things that you could use nickel or something else for, because it's very rare. So it's going to go to the use cases where the people or the consumer, the end consumers, are willing to pay the highest price. And so you're not just taking gold and using it to fill a pothole or something like that, which if you don't have those price signals, you would end up doing something similar to that. So if you're a Marxist and you think that the way we get to this socialist utopia and how we move society forward and increase the standard of living for everyone, and ironically enough, I think they truly believe that this is how we do produce more goods and services. They understand, the smart ones do, understand that wealth is not currency units or dollars or even gold or Bitcoin. Or real estate. Wealth is goods and services. And so I think the ones that are intellectually honest and that have integrity, I think they truly believe that that's the way that you increase the standard of living, by increasing the amount of goods and services produced by an economy. But to your point, they do that through artificial intelligence instead of through price discovery in the messy free market, which it is. It is very messy. You're always going to have Schumpeter's creative destruction, or we would like to see that. Ever since the GFC, we don't, of course, have it at all, because no one is allowed to fail. Large corporations aren't allowed to fail, so we don't have free market capitalism. We have something called corporatism. And you know, it really gets under my skin when these CNN types or Krugman types always look at the GFC and say, well, there you go. That's what happens when you get capitalism. I mean, you might as well just tattoo ignorant on your forehead. It's just a knuckle dragger response to the GFC. When in reality, it was the opposite of free market capitalism. It's when you had the government pushing these bad loans, first and foremost. You got to ask yourself the question, why didn't we have a GFC? Why didn't we have a housing crisis, a massive collapse like we saw in 2008 for the past 100 years? Did we not have a real estate market in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, in the year 1900, in the year 1890? Did we just not have a real estate market then? Well, of course we did. So why did we just have this massive crash come in 2008? Did all of a sudden people on Wall Street become greedy? Like they're somehow altruistic throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And all of a sudden in the late 90s or the early 2000s, they just became really, really greedy. Again, it's a knuckle dragger way of looking at the world, and at very best, it's a second grader way of looking at the world. Obviously, something had to happen. And what happened? Well, going all the way up to the late 90s, it was common for a bank to issue a mortgage when someone would have to put 20% down. Those of you who are my age, that's kind of, I think, I would imagine that's the first thing that pops into your head if I were to ask you, okay, how much do banks require for you to put down for a mortgage? I would assume most of you my age or older would say, oh, 20%. If you're 30 years or younger, I'm guessing your answer would be 5% or 3%. The average down payment, even today, people think that lending standards have gotten better or tighter. No, they haven't. Not even close, at least not in the housing market. Still, the required down payment today is very similar to what it was in 2005 and 2006, right around maybe 5, 6%. Something like that. So that's what changed, is the government came in and said, no. You're being way too unfair. You banks are racist. You're misogynist, or whatever the buzzword was at the time. You need to extend loans to all these other people so they can have the American dream. It doesn't matter if you have a 400 credit score. The credit scores are racist. And you got Barney Frank and Chris Dodd out there saying that we just need to push more loans and more loans and more loans. And then ironically enough, those are the two knuckleheads that are chosen to write the regulations for the banks that collapsed because of all of the bad policies that they were pushing from, call it 2001 to 2007. It is, you can't find a better example of the firefighter or the arsonist and the firefighter being one and the same than the example of Chris Dodd and Barney Frank. But my point is, that was really a tangent right there, wasn't it? But that's, you get market intervention, or you get the intervention in the market, and it never ends well. It's just, you've got to have this creative destruction, Schumpeter's creative destruction. And we had the government come in, and they created, there's a lot of factors in there, but they were the major party that was responsible for the GFC. And then what happens? We don't allow free market capitalism to work. We come in and bail out all the banks. Well, now all of a sudden, what are the banks going to do after they know you're going to bail them out? They're going to take more risk. And then we have the derivatives market go to a quadrillion. And people are wondering why that happened, because the banks get bailed out and they know that they can take as much risk as they want and there's no downside. I mean, is it any surprise that the stock market, everyone's gone so far out the risk curve? I mean, is it any surprise that these NFTs of these drunken cartoon monkeys are selling for $10 million? Of course not. That's what's going to happen when you basically privatize profits and socialize losses, and you keep interest rates at 0% for over a decade, and you take the Fed's balance sheet up to $8 trillion, and the government is just deficit spending to the tune of $4 to $5 trillion per year, and all that's being monetized by the Fed. I mean, what do you expect to happen? I mean, we are distorting the market to an extent to which we have never seen in the United States. And then we're calling it free market capitalism. Not even close. Not even close. So my point, going back to your question with the AI, is I think the central planners know the reason why, one of the main reasons why Russia failed. And I think that's another reason why they'll move to a central bank digital currency. Because to pull off what you're saying, where AI controls the allocation of scarce resources with alternative uses, the way that price discovery and the price signals and the mechanism of the price signals are in order for them to achieve the same outcome, I should say. And let me say this a little bit better here so I'm clear. In order for AI to achieve the same outcome, and this is them speaking, not me, that the price signals and price discovery achieve now, is they have to have that data in real time. So the only way to get that data in real time is if you have a central bank digital currency. Why? Because that means that all of us and the entities in the real economy, small business, large business, corporations, doesn't matter, have accounts with the Fed. So every one of those transactions in the entire United States go into their cloud, let's call it, in real time, And then that AI can crunch the data and tell the central planners that now own the means of production, and this is, you know, sometime in the future, where they need to allocate those resources. I think this is how they see, I think this is their framework. And I think this is kind of their game plan as to how they get to a world where we have equality of outcome instead of equality of opportunity. Because if you read everything that they say, and now I'm specifically talking about the World Economic Forum, they just openly come out and say that we need more equal outcomes, not opportunities, outcomes. And that is one hell of a slippery slope, because none of us are, all of us are created equal in the eyes of God, if you want to look at that. No person is better than anyone else, but we all have different skill sets, right? No person is morally or ethically or should have rights that other people do not have, right? I guess there's people that are morally and ethically different, but everyone should be equal at birth. They should have equal opportunity, right? To the best of our ability. Now, you can take that to an extreme to where the only way that you would have just absolute equal opportunity is if human beings meddled in the free market system. And you don't want that either. You know, the fact is I'm 6'4". So I'm always going to have an advantage, you know, 99.9% of the time. I'm going to have an advantage in the game of basketball compared to someone who's 5'1" and weighs 100 pounds. It is what it is, right? You're never going to make those two people equal at basketball. But it doesn't mean that one person is better as a human being than the other. I think that's what I'm trying to say. And they're trying to get this 5'1" person to be just as good at basketball, or as perceived by the general public, as the person who's 6'9" and looks like Shaquille O'Neal. And you know, just take that to its logical conclusion, right? I mean, what would the NBA look like, right? We'd have 5 foot Asian dudes in the NBA competing against Kevin Durant or something like that, right? And they would just get handicapped, like they, you know, and they'd have to have a tie game at the end. I mean, it just gets completely bananas if you go down the Klaus path. But really, to summarize here, I think that's the direction the central planners are going, and I think they believe that AI can achieve those objectives. And obviously, I think that they're in for a rude awakening, because AI is created by men. And I get it. You know, it can improve itself and yada, yada, yada. But whenever men or women, just a human race is what I'm referring to, have tried to intervene with in complex systems such as the economy, such as nature, it never ends well. Never, ever ends well. And it's ironic that these people that push for socialism and intervening in a complex system like the economy are so adamant about never, ever, ever intervening in a complex system like the climate. You see, I mean, they're, and you know, the climate change and whatnot, they're just, mankind cannot have any influence over the climate at all, or else it's Armageddon. But yet those same people say, oh yeah, human beings, we should micromanage the economy. How is it any different? It's a complex system. Same thing, right? But anyway, I could literally go on the entire hour about that one question, because that gets into social scores, and that gets into the available credit, that gets into the dollar, that gets into inflation, deflation, disinflation, the euro dollar system. I could honestly go on for probably 2 or 3 hours on that one question, but let me keep going here. What about CDOs from 2008? Isn't this the elephant in the room? Aren't they being recategorized in 2022? Does this have any underhanded effects with the elites and exploding housing prices now? No, I mean, the balance sheets of the banking system are far different than they were back in 2008. I mean, first and foremost, you got to look at the Fed's balance sheet, because the bank reserves that you see on the Fed's balance sheet, liability of the Fed, that's going to be an asset of the commercial banks. So let's just think about this. Prior to the GFC, the Fed's balance sheet, in other words, their liabilities, about $800 billion. Now, not 100% of that were bank reserves, but let's just assume that they were. So on the asset side of the commercial bank's balance sheet, that means they would have that $800 billion as assets. Now it's $8 trillion plus and growing. So it is true that they had the treasuries to buy and the mortgage-backed securities in the first place. But they've got a lot more liquidity to handle a blow up in the derivatives market. Now, who knows to the degree in which these derivatives exist, especially we've always heard about Deutsche Bank and their derivatives book, and that absolutely no one can figure it out, and no one knows the size of it. So there's always that potential and that possibility. But I think, Susan, it's a great question, but we're living in a world where there's so much intervention, and we just will not allow businesses to go bust, nor will we allow the banks to go bust. And, this is something that Jeff Snyder pointed out to me in one of our conversations, and it really helps me understand the world from an economic standpoint a lot better. And so let me share it with you. Basically, if you guys have watched my videos for quite some time, you'll know that I always talk about how in the past, and we're kind of living in this weird hybrid system now, but the commercial banks were really responsible for creating the majority of dollars, especially outside of the United States, when you consider the Euro banking system. So the central bankers and the people at the Fed, they get this. They understand that they are not in control of the dollar. The only thing they have is expectation policy. The only thing they have is psychology. The only thing they have is trying to manipulate you to do their bidding by going out and buying risk assets. So if they understand that they don't control the dollar, they know who does or who did to a large degree. And that was the commercial banks. So what happens if you let the commercial banks fail? It's not just letting JP Morgan fail or Goldman Sachs or Deutsche. It's the whole house of cards comes crashing down. It's done. And I'm not just talking about the US economy. I'm talking about the global economy. Because what supplies dollars? It's the commercial banking system. And it would be like turning off the repo market. It would be like just turning a dial and saying, okay, we're done with that. There's no more dollar liquidity for the entire globe. So think about how much dollar-denominated debt is out there. I mean, you're talking about a complete implosion of the global economy that would make the Great Depression look like a five-year-old's birthday party. And unfortunately, that's the world we live in. The central banks know this, and therefore, I think one of the safest bets in macro is that banks, especially those global banks that are a big, huge part of the euro dollar market and the repo market, they're always going to be bailed out, always moving forward until they can't be. And I think we're going to get to a point where even the Fed can't bail them out, that they have to come collapsing in on themselves, kind of like a dying star. Now, what that catalyst is, I think, is probably on the fiscal side now. I think once we get a situation where we have a lack of fiscal, that's probably the catalyst that brings the whole, where the Titanic hits the iceberg, so to speak. But until that time, Susan, I think the central banks, global central banks, are going to be coming in and doing whatever they can to prop up the commercial banks, regardless of their risk taking, their derivatives book, or you know, how badly their balance sheet collapses.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Oh, I don't know this. Who's the marketing outfit that provides the daily news feed that seems to be strangely consistent with topic and read over all networks verbatim? And do they hold a backlog of stories for, I don't know. I mean, is that the Associated Press maybe? I don't know, Jason. That's kind of out of my wheelhouse, my friend. Will you help me start a unified movement against totalitarian forces? I think I'm trying to do that on my own. I'm already trying my hardest. Well, not my hardest, but that's one of the main reasons I rented space from Kiyosaki, and I want to start or build a studio, and I've hired some employees to come in from all over the United States to really take the content to the next level. The whiteboards won't change at all, because I think those are pretty much as good as I can do. But as far as my interviews and as far as the content that's produced on the Rebel Capitalist channel, we're really going to take it to a whole new level, because you guys have heard me talk about this constantly, but it's just so true that right now, although wealth is important and your portfolio is important, and obviously the price of your house or how you're investing, or if you're buying Bitcoin or gold or commodities, inflation, deflation, all these things are very important. But I don't think there is, but I think the real pressing matter is our personal freedom and liberty right now. I think it's like being in a house that's on fire and worrying that the toilet is broken. The toilet being broken is a problem that needs to be addressed. But we've got to address that problem after we put out the fire. Because if the whole house burns down, then that toilet being fixed isn't going to do you any good. And I think it's the same thing right now with investing your portfolio, growing your wealth, and that being the toilet. That's probably not a good analogy. But then obviously the house being on fire is referencing the attack on our personal freedom and liberty. So that's really what I'm trying to allocate 100% of my mental bandwidth to, at least for the next 6 months, to see if I can move the needle at all. I think I can, though. I really believe I can. And so we're going to be coming out with hopefully 2, 3, 4, maybe pieces of content daily on the Rebel Capitalist channel, setting up a studio. It's going to look professional. I understand that most of you really don't care about my backdrop, and you know, I can wear a baseball hat. You guys know me, so it doesn't really matter. You're here just for the content. And I sincerely appreciate you being here, even with the lack of professionalism, let's say. But if I'm going to reach the average Joe and Jane, if I'm going to reach the average CNN viewer that is, you know, not so brainwashed that they're just too far gone, if I'm going to reach that person that, you know, might not seek out a video like this or a video like one of my whiteboards or one of my interviews, but they know that something just isn't right. They just have that feeling in their stomach that, you know, we're sending out these stimmy checks. It's a $5 trillion deficit. I don't know really about what the Fed does, but the fact that they're buying, you know, mortgages like $40 billion, like that just doesn't seem right. So I need to reach those people. And if those people, if you guys share a video, let's say you share this video with one of your friend and family member Freds, they're going to look at my hat. They're going to look at this background and they're going to say, who is this clown? Yes, why are you sending me this nonsense? They're not even going to give me the time of day. They're not going to listen to one word I'm saying. Even if the message is powerful, even if the content is strong, and even if I back it up with facts and charts and all, it just doesn't matter. As human beings, we make a snap decision on people just like that. It is what it is. So that's why I'm really going to focus on you know, getting a professional looking studio. And it's not going to be anything fancy. It's not going to look like CNBC or anything, but something that's just a little more presentable. So if you email or share a video with your friend and family member, Fred, that they'll be like, okay, well, let me at least listen to this guy let me give him at least 30 seconds or a minute, because he looks like he's professional. It looks like he knows what he's talking about. And then hopefully we can sink the hook from there and open up their eyes to what's really truly happening in the world around them and why they too need to stand up for freedom, just like we are standing up for freedom. They need to understand the urgency that all of us understand. And that's going to be one of the ways that I'm going to tackle the problem. So let me get back to the questions here. I know that was quite a tangent. Yeah, so you're talking about my video with Gerald Celente, and that's what I'm doing. I'm going to be doing this on my own, but I'm going to be doing my best to organize the group of YouTubers that you guys all know and love, like Mark Moss and Lynette Zhang, and several others, Gerald being one of them. And try to really make a push and grab people's attention. The good news is, although they won't come out and say it, just FYI, 99% of the people that I interview on my channel that are macro guys and gals, trust me, they see the world the exact same way you guys do, from a standpoint of freedom and liberty. They can't come out and say it, obviously, because they manage investor money and they still have jobs and they've got a family to provide for and whatnot. But they are, you know, they're very concerned, just like you are, about freedom and liberty. And these are the smartest people in the room, right? So I'm not going to mention any names, but just know that there's a lot more people out there and a lot of smart people that have the same concerns and see the world the way you do. And want me, and I'm sure other YouTubers that have the flexibility to stand up and fight. And I think we're going to win, but we've got to have a sense of urgency. And I do. I can tell you that right now. Where do you see gold going at the end of the year? I'm not sure where gold is going to be at the end of the year, but I'm really liking gold. And let me be more specific, because you guys know, most of you, that I like this 10-80-10 portfolio. And I haven't talked about that in quite a while because I've been so focused on the fight for freedom thing. But, you know, so that would be 10% insurance, 80% investments. And I define that as things that pay you to own them, and 10% speculative assets. They might not pay you to own them, but you think there's good asymmetry, there's good risk reward, and that you can buy these things super cheap. And so for you, maybe Bitcoin may fall into that category. For me, Bitcoin is a speculative asset. That's not a derogatory term. It's just the way I define things. But gold is insurance. And a lot of people have asked me, in fact, even this weekend when I was speaking at Hartman's conference, a lot of people say, well, why hasn't gold gone up in price? You know, why hasn't gold gone up in price? I'm like, well, I don't know, man. Maybe it's not supposed to. Oh, I thought it was an inflation hedge and we're seeing inflation. Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know that gold is, to a certain extent it is, but it's just meant to keep its purchasing power. It's just to maintain purchasing power. That's pretty much it. And sometimes gold gets way ahead of inflation. And sometimes it lags a little bit behind. But over a 10-year span, over a 100-year span, over a 1,000-year span, you can always buy the same amount of stuff with an ounce of gold. It's just that's the way it works. For at least for the last 5,000 years, that's the way it's worked. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. So if you're really trying to grow your wealth and not just protect it, then you look at the gold miners, because those are, to me, not insurance. Those are speculative assets. And I think they're getting pretty, I don't know if I would say cheap, but they're getting very interesting. Let's just say that. I'm definitely putting them on my watch list, because people really hate gold right now. Obviously, they're kind of a derivative of gold. But people really hate gold right now. They don't. It's very unloved. And, oh, it's gold is dead. You hear that all the time. Oh, gold's dead. Everyone's just going to buy Bitcoin and crypto now. Okay. That's what I like to hear. Because when everyone forgets about an asset class, when everyone just throws it in the trash and neglects it, that's when I get interested. When everyone's talking about it and you see it 1,000 times a day on CNBC and the Uber drivers talking about it and all your friends and family member Freds are talking about it, that's when I'm like, I don't know. I might like it long term, but that makes me very uncomfortable. And so I like it when nobody is talking about it, and the people that are talking about it are just saying how it's lost its luster. It's a barbarous relic, and it's never going to go up in price again, because all of the capital flows will be going into cryptocurrency for the rest of humanity. Yeah. Okay. What's funny is I was talking to a kid, real smart kid, this weekend. And he was really excited about crypto. And you know, listen, I'm bullish Bitcoin long term. I mean, I've been bullish. You guys know that, going back to when I first started my channel. I mean, I've been bullish on Bitcoin longer than that. But I started talking about it. But you know, I think there's a place in the portfolio for both, and it's very wise to own both. And just to say gold is dead, I don't think that's very smart. And to say that Bitcoin does the job of gold, I think that's utterly ridiculous. To say that it's it's an insurance policy, come on. And so this kid was like, yeah, he was the one that was kind of saying gold is dead and all of these things, and that that now the new inflation hedge and the new insurance policy is Bitcoin and maybe some other cryptocurrencies. And I was standing around a group of probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 people. And I said, let me tell you why I think gold is insurance and Bitcoin is a really good speculation. I said, if all of you had to bet your entire net worth right now, as we speak, as to what is still going to exist in 100 years, would you bet your entire net worth on gold or Bitcoin? And everyone kind of laughed. And then the kid that was, you know, saying gold is dead, he immediately changed the subject. And everyone kind of say, oh, no, you got it. Come on now. You got to answer the question. And I think it's a pretty easy question to answer. You know, what if you had to bet your entire net worth, what will still exist in 100 years, gold or Bitcoin? I think that's a pretty easy bet. At least for me, it is. And that's why gold is insurance. And that's why at the current time, Bitcoin is, I think, a great speculative asset if you buy it at the right time. You want to buy panic and you don't want to buy hysteria. So, oh, okay, where do I see gold being at the end of the year? Sorry, I forgot. I didn't even answer the original question. I don't know, but I don't really care. And I don't mean to dismiss your question, Seymour, because it's a great question. But the reason I say it that way is because I see gold as an insurance policy. I literally buy it at any price because I just know that it's it's like car insurance. Even if, if you said, George, you're going to spend, $12,000, well, I wouldn't spend that much, but let's say you're going to spend, $2,000 this year on car insurance as an example. But you're not going to have a car accident. Aren't you pissed off that you lost that $2,000? No. What are you talking about? Of course, I'm not pissed off that I lost that $2,000 and I didn't have a car crash. So it's the same way with gold, you know. Oh, geez, George, you bought at 1800. Aren't you pissed off because it's been 6 months and gold's at 1700? No, what are you talking about? That's not the reason I buy gold. So, now the gold miners, Seymour, different question. The gold miners, I have no clue where the price will be because that's not how I invest, but I am putting them on that, watch list. And for me, they are getting very interesting. So I'll say that.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
What would life be without central banks? Well, would there be more or less problems? I mean, you're talking to a guy that's wearing an End the Fed hat. So I'd point that out first and foremost. Maybe this is a rhetorical question. Obviously, you know what I'm going to say. I think there would be fewer problems, but let me tell you why. I think that's maybe a more interesting way to answer this question. And it goes back to sound money. And it goes back to limiting the size of government and limiting the power of government. One thing that fiat money does, or if you allow the central bank, or if you have central banks there to monetize the debt of the government, it allows the government to do things like go to war. I don't think that's good. I think the country should have a good defense mechanism to keep its citizens safe. But I don't like the central bank just giving the government the ability to just be in wars forever. There's no end to it because we can just print the money. Also, that's a taxation on the poor and middle class, especially because the inflation is the hidden tax that is completely regressive, meaning it disproportionately affects the poor and middle class because the stuff that they buy that's a larger majority of their income overall is going up significantly in price. So therefore, their standard of living is decreasing. So effectively, the government and the central bank is stealing from them, and they don't even know it, to pay for XYZ war, or to pay for anything for that matter, to pay for XYZ stimulus package, or to send out stimmy checks, or you name it. You know, what we've seen in 2020 and 2021, let's say inflation has been 15%, and for a lot of items, I'm probably understating it, but that's just basically the government stealing from the poor and middle class. And, you know, I think one of the reasons we had something called the Revolutionary War is because of taxation without representation. That's exactly what inflation is. And that inflation, my point is, that inflation would be very difficult without a central bank. And if we just had a gold standard as an example, possibly even a Bitcoin standard. That's a different topic, but let's just assume a gold standard. I mean, go back to the 1800s, for heaven's sakes. I would argue go back to the 1820s, the 1830s, the 1840s, because if my memory serves me right, we've had three central banks in the U.S. Most people don't realize that. Alexander Hamilton obviously started the first. He might have started the second too. I can't remember. But I think the second, they put the kibosh on it in the 1820s, or maybe it was 1836, right around there. But from the time they abolished the second central bank to the Civil War, we had something called free banking. The government was not involved with the banking system at all. In fact, the banks printed their own currency. But most people don't know that. That if you would have gone to a bank over there, they'd have some red and purple, and you go to this other bank and it's yellow, and it's all these different currencies, and most of them were interchangeable, and they're all backed by gold. But you look at what happened. From the year 1800 to the year 1900, prices went down in the United States by 50%, 50%. That's a staggering number when you really think through what that means. I want to point out that average incomes went up in nominal terms during that time. So think about what's happening as nominal incomes are going up. And nominal GDP, by the way, is going up. And you have interest rates at 4% nominal, so real interest rates at, say, 7%. All of that's happening with a backdrop of consumer prices going down by, call it, 2 or 3% compounded per year. What you get is an environment where the poor and middle class, where their standard of living is skyrocketing. It's skyrocketing. And it isn't necessarily because they're making tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of extra money. The way we view it now is the only possibility. No, it's because the price of the stuff they're buying goes down and down and down and down so they can afford more and more and more. And this is what would occur if you have a free market capitalist society with sound money. And that's most likely what we would have, at least in the United States. Well, maybe not now, because the government is just so overblown and we have so much regulation, government spending. But if you could start from scratch, that's what we would have, with small government and a sound currency, low taxes, very low regulations, and minus a central bank. There's nothing that you could do to better improve the lives of the poor and middle class than to have sound money and therefore eliminate the central bank. And that's why I wear this hat. That's why I wear it on. I don't wear it just to, you know, poke fun at the Fed or Jerome Powell or there's a reason. And it would solve so many problems. And I mean, from war to poverty, it wouldn't completely eradicate them, obviously, because at the end of the day, we are all imperfect human beings living in an imperfect world. And therefore, there will never, ever, ever, ever be a perfect system. Not even close. But we have to look at what the least imperfect system is. And the least imperfect system we have that we can create as human beings, as these flawed creatures that are walking around this planet, the least imperfect system we can create is free market capitalism and small government with sound money. And you just look at any country or any economy that has employed those methods, and magically, what do? They become very, very successful. And it's unbelievable that economists and central planners and politicians and the Klauses of the world and the IMF, it's just baffling that they can't look around and see that has happened over and over and over and over and over again, and then say, weird. Almost every time we do that, it works really, really well. So what should we do now? Oh, I don't know. Let's just do the opposite of that. That's basically what they're doing with the Marxists, the central planners, and this push towards socialism, just and corporatism. And bailing out the banks and bailing out this business and that corporation and bailout. No, it's just we've got to let those corporations and those businesses fail. But that just, what is that? What does that system look like? It's just free market capitalism, for heaven's sakes. What can I say about Russian markets? Sergey, in Rebel Capitalist Pro, we talk about Russia a lot because my two partners, Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, have done extensive research in the Russian market. Last time I was really involved with one of those discussions was probably about 6 months ago. And I know at that time they were still very bullish, not just Russia in general, but a lot of the commodity producers in Russia. And I remember, and this could have changed, why I prefaced by saying it was 6 months ago, because they could be in a completely different opinion now. So just kind of take this with a grain of salt. But back then, Lukoil oil was something that we were really talking about a lot in Rebel Capitalist Pro. We, meaning Chris and Lynn, as something that could be an opportunity. Spurbank, I believe, is their bank there. That was Lynn has done a lot of deep dives on Spurbank. Hopefully I'm saying that right. And their investments in technology and their dividend and their balance sheet, very, very, very strong. So everyone knows the downsides to the Russian market. I don't have to repeat that. But there was some very cheap assets as of 6 months ago that we were talking about in Rebel Capitalist Pro. And every single time I talk to Jim Rogers, Jim has bought he's made a lot of money in Russia over the last 10 years, not just with equities, but with bonds as well. You know, when they had their currency blow up, what was it? Maybe 4 or 5 years ago now. And they had to really jack interest rates. I know Jim went in and bought a ton of ruble denominated bonds, which as you can tell by a chart, he got paid handsomely for, and he made an absolute killing on those. And, you know, whether it's that or a fertilizer company, he's done extremely well. So I know there's definitely pockets of opportunity. As far as the overall broad market, I don't know that I have any insights there. But as far as me personally, definitely on my watch list. And there's probably more companies in Russia right now that I would be interested in. I'm not saying I would buy them, but that I would be interested in than probably the United States, for sure. Do you think it would be possible to make our own country a libertarian country where government doesn't take half of GDP? Well, or government spending isn't 60% of GDP. I mean, I think one thing that we can be optimistic about, and we should study, and to get kind of the basics on this, I would strongly suggest listening to the Tom Woods podcast. That's one of my favorites. And I listen to it as much as I can. And he talks a lot about secession. And that's basically Texas or Florida just telling the U.S. to pound sand. And that, you know, we're out. Have a good one. It was nice knowing you. And them just governing themselves. And it's something that is far more possible than people believe. And so that, you know, because you look around the world today and you say, my gosh, you know, the whole planet's gone mad. Every country has just taken this totalitarian approach in 2020 and 2021. You know, where is there a ray of optimism? And I think that's something that we should really think through and maybe start to dive into a lot deeper and potentially start talking about and promoting is Texas or Florida or one of those states just seceding from the union. And it wouldn't have to be war or anything. You'd be done peacefully, legally. And it might really move the needle. So instead of starting our own country, maybe that could be a more realistic option. All right, guys, let me do some shout outs. I got to get over to Rebel Capitalist Pro to do a live stream over there. We've got Malaysia Numismatic in the house. I want to give him a shout out. I think he's coming in. Well, obviously coming here probably from Malaysia. So I have no idea what time it is there, but thank you for joining us, my friend. You are always on these live streams, and I greatly appreciate it. Who else? Oh, All Nighter Hider is here as well. Getting Ahead, Mexi Mike, Mitchell Goslin, another regular, Eric the Half a Bee, Doc Oz, Brian Bradley, Richard Burton, Matthew Silva, Moody's in the house, Rachel Gauger, Dickie Dunn, Stephen Tiralongo, Econ Dropout. Was it Econ Dropout? That's it. Angelique's in the house. Jairo Hernandez. That's the way you pronounce that. Charles Cook. Jim Wolf. Ian Gonzalez. Zabutify. Holy cow. We got some Rebel Capitalist Pro members in the house on the public live stream. All right, guys. Enjoy the rest of your evening. I'll see you in the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.